Good morning, and welcome to the Texas Scorecard Friday Roundup. I'm your host, Jacob Asmussen, filling in this week for our managing editor, Brandon Waltons. We have a great show for you today. We're going to cover some of the biggest stories happening across the state right now. Today, I'm joined with the Director of Urban Reform, Charles Blaine, as well as the Texas Scorecard publisher, Michael Quinn Sullivan. Have a great conversation for you lined up today. So let's get right into it. Gentlemen, the polls are open. It's election season. Texans are heading to the ballot box to make some crucial decisions. So just take us through what's happening right now. What are some of the biggest storylines happening across the state right now that citizens need to be aware of? Michael, we'll start with you.
Yeah, look, Matt, I think it's real easy for all of us to get caught up in the national push for, who's going to be the president, that, which is all, dreadfully important stuff. But it's easy to lose sight of the equally, in some ways, if not more so, important races at the state and local levels around the state, because those are levels of government that most directly affect Texans, which, of course, is why it's nice to be sitting here, for me, virtually, with Charles, because he has such a fantastic view on what's going on in the largest metropolitan area in the state. And in fact, the issues in Houston replicating in the other urban areas around the state are in many ways going to determine what Texas looks like over the next decade. No story is probably more important practically for Texans than the control of the Texas House. Democrats in 2018 flipped about a dozen seats from Republican to Democrat. They're hoping to do the same thing this go-round by flipping, all they do is flip 9 seats to turn the House from a Republican-controlled House to a Democrat-controlled House. In fact, they only have to pick up something less than that to have functional control of the Texas House, which goes to redistricting, which goes to the budget, which goes to a whole lot of big issues that are at play in the Lone Star State. So if folks aren't paying attention to those legislative races, and they're only focusing on the establishment media, the cable news network, dog and pony show of Team Trump versus Team Biden, we could well miss out on some things.
Yeah, take us into that further, Charles. Break that down for us. What are some of the big storylines and races in the Houston area?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. I obviously love this show. I watch it every week, so I'm excited to be on. But what's been interesting, I think what's been dominating the conversation, particularly in Houston and Harris County this past week, has been this kind of just voting issue. You've seen a lot of lawsuits coming from the state and from private parties as well. I know our local party, as well as some private individuals, have sued to try to limit this kind of massive expansion of voting locations and times and just kind of ways that our local county clerk has done. So now we have like drive-through voting, we have a day of 24-hour voting, we have this like drive, they're kind of like sonic drive-ups, yeah. We have like those, and there's all these different things and things that are going on within that, with people saying that they're coming in at cars of 4 and 5 and voting for family members who may be in the car, but there's conversation when there shouldn't be. So there's like a lot of question about kind of the integrity of it all. And that's been dominating a lot of the conversation locally for us. But I mean, of course, like Michael said, the state house is where everybody should be focused who isn't focused. I think I've heard a lot of grassroots folks who really know what's at stake focused on that. But kind of the public at large seems to be focused really heavily on the national and federal elections. But it's so important what happens at the state, because that's what's going to determine, again, like you said, redistricting, but also all the priorities going forward when January comes and the session starts. We've got some races in our backyard at Houston that are crucial. 138, there's Lacey Hall running against Akila Basie, and they're both trying to go after Dwayne Bohack's seat that he vacated, if you will, or decided not to run again. And so that's been a tight race, and that's been really interesting. A lot of folks are there for that. There's a massive deployment of young Republicans coming out to the district to walk this weekend for that race. You've got 133 where John Rosenthal beat, I can't even remember who the former state rep was, but he took that seat over and flipped it last cycle, and they're hoping to flip it back this time with Justin Ray. But then my backyard, my personal backyard, 134, Sarah Davis's district, you know, it's funny because they always say that Republicans like Sarah Davis are safe in whatever scenario they're thrown in because they can weather any storm. But this race is looking like a close one. And I ride my bike through you know, West U and that whole area all the time in House District 134. And to see the signs out there, it doesn't seem like she's going to pull it off this time, but we'll see what happens. But I do think people really need to be focused on those state races because they are quite important. And, you know, it's easy to get caught up in everything that's happening on the national level, but what's happening in our backyard is crucial.
So we talk about these. Oh, go ahead, Michael.
And I would note, you've got these Harris County races, but you then also have up in Dallas County, we only have two Republican office holders left in the legislative delegation. The Democrats spending big against them. At the same time, though, you see Republicans in Dallas County who are kind of rallying to take back a couple of the seats, you know, kind of like Charles was noting there in Harris County. No, there is an effort to take back some seats. You know, this is one in my 25 years of watching state politics. This is the first time when you could see either Republicans gain seats and you know, further cement their majority, or you could see Democrats take control. I mean, there's this wild spread of outcomes this session, and it's all going to determine, you know, how much people are really paying attention to these kinds of races. You've got, you know, solidly conservative Collin County, we all think, where you've got Jeff Leach and Matt Shaheen, who are under fierce attack, and no one seems to kind of beyond kind of the confines of that district realize what would happen if you start losing Collin County to the Democrats. That doesn't bode well in just a whole lot of scenarios.
And we're seeing hundreds of thousands of dollars, I mean, all kinds of money pouring into the state to bolster Democrats. Democrats definitely have their eye on Texas. You know, like you said, Michael, they only need 9 seats to flip the Texas House. And political scientist Mark Jones of Rice University says that 27 of the races are competitive. So we talk about these races, though, but tell us more about what that could mean if Democrats took control of the House. I know y'all mentioned redistricting. I mean, what is that even for people who don't know?
So that's the setting of the boundaries for everything. Everything that has a political jurisdiction to it. You know, think U.S. Congress. Think the Texas Senate. The State House. Down even into the local levels where those entities are dividing up their various precincts. You know, all those lines start coming into play because of the census that will just be completed and congressional seats. So Texas is going to be adding 2, maybe 3 congressional seats. And so if you have the Democrats take control, whether actually numerically or functionally, you can end up then with not only a bigger Texas delegation, but a bigger Texas delegation that is Democrat majority. And that's that starts shifting the national conversation. That starts shifting a lot of politics nationwide and even globally when you start seeing, because who draws the lines? In many cases, they can't balance a budget. They can't do a whole lot of things with numbers. But politicians are really good at drawing lines to ensure partisan outcomes. And generally speaking, Democrats draw lines to benefit Democrats. Republicans draw lines to benefit the Republicans. And that one issue alone, Jacob, is probably cause, for concern, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, about the power that's going to rest in the Texas House of Representatives in 2021.
And Michael mentioned, even the local level with redistricting, Houston City Council, they're talking about how they're going to, when the census comes in, they're going to have to look at their lines, look at the population shifts and see how they're going to restructure it too. And that's going to make a big impact for folks who live, like I do, kind of on the border of two different districts. It can mean, having really active, engaged representation or absent representation who cares about a very specific community or very specific issue that doesn't involve me. So I think, people really need to pay attention to that. And I think you alluded to this kind of what's at stake going forward. And, you know, one of the precincts that we have that are up for re-election, or that's up on this ballot, it's actually not for re-election, Commissioner Steve Raddick, he's not running again, and this is Precinct 3, so this is like going out towards kind of Katy and kind of the west side of Houston, and an area that has typically been kind of a Republican area, and so they're actually thinking that this seat could potentially flip this time around. I mean, they're really trying to hold it, and I think there's a lot of effort to hold it, and there's a good chance it'll be held, but it could flip. And so for Harris County residents, practically that means that right now the Republicans are in a minority on Commissioner's Court as it is, so there's really not much they could stop. But if you'll recall, I know you guys wrote about this, I wrote about this, a couple months ago, the new county judge and the Democratic commissioners tried to push through a tax increase, and the only way that the Republicans were able to stop it was because they had two who were unwilling to show up for the meeting. And so if that seat flips and they try to do that next year, Harris County residents are getting tax increase because there's no way that they're going to be able, none of the Democrats are going to skip that meeting, and one commissioner, one Republican commissioner not showing up isn't going to stop it. And so, you know, you have these like very practical things that are happening. And so, again, I think it goes to the point that, you know, everybody's focused on such high level politics and kind of the broader national discussion. But really, when you get local, there are so many issues at stake.
Hmm. Well, and I'll tell you, Charles, you know, you mentioned the step removed from the election, when we talk about the local impact for voters on taxes, but even on the ballot, Jacob, you wrote this past week about the massive tax increase that the Austin City Council wants the taxpayers in Austin to levy upon themselves. And if you don't show up and vote, on the one hand, if you don't show up and vote, your neighbor's going to pick some bad city council member who's going to raise your taxes. But at least in Austin and a number of other jurisdictions, if you don't show up and vote, your neighbor may be raising your taxes on November 3rd. You know, so the Jacob, this monstrous tax increase you wrote about, coming at a time when businesses have already been shuttered, when families have seen their incomes reduced because of the coronavirus mandates. This could really kill a lot of small businesses and harm families for a long time to come.
Well, absolutely, Michael. And like you said, during a time when at least 132,000 Austinites are out of work, and millions of Texans across the state are out of work because of government shutdowns, Austin officials want to take, over $300 more next year from the average, or from the median homeowner. And so, like y'all said, this November election is not just about going and picking the American Idol president, right, and then going home. Right, there are all of these races at the state level, at the local level, that will directly impact citizens' lives, their ability to afford a place to live for their families. Yeah. That people need to know, that people need to show up for. And so, thank you so much for joining us, Michael. Appreciate your time.
Hey, it's great to be with you and the amazing Charles Blaine. Hey, real quick, if you happen to live in Houston, you need to catch the Sunday morning talk shows there in Houston, because Charles Blaine is a regular feature there. And remind me, Charles, that's Fox 7?
Fox 26. Yes.
Fox 26, sorry about that. So you can see a lot more of Charles Blaine. And also make sure you check out Urban Reform. Go online, find urbanreform.org. Keep up with all the work that Charles Blaine does. I'm a real champion, bring some real clarity to issues facing voters in urban areas. Appreciate your work, Charles.
Thank you, Michael.
Absolutely. Just constant gold nuggets from Charles. Well, great. Well, I want to shift to talking to you about a piece you wrote at TexasScorecard.com this week. So we just talked about elections, right? But elections have consequences, as the saying goes. And those consequences really mean whoever gets in power, they get to enact either helpful or harmful laws on citizens. And so you had a piece about something Democrat progressive elected officials want to do if they're in power, and that's this guaranteed income concept, and it's kind of spreading across the nation. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is, and what would it mean if Democrat officials enacted that?
Yeah, so it's crazy, and it's coming to a city near you, which I think was the title of the article. But so back in June, 11 city mayors got together and they said, we want to do this guaranteed basic income in our cities. And so they created a coalition called Mayors for Guaranteed Basic Income, GBI. And essentially what it is, if you think back to the Democratic primaries, you heard Andrew Yang talk about the universal basic income. I think it was $1,000 or $1,500 a month, every month, forever, for everyone. Wow. But what they want to do is they want to take kind of the lower percentile, lower socioeconomic spectrum folks, and give them a defined amount per month, some indefinitely, some for a set amount of time. And so 11 mayors got together to do this. But what kind of alarmed me is that after this launched in June, and by September 29th, the end of September, 20 mayors had signed on to this. Mm-hmm. And so you have mayors in Stockton, California, Los Angeles, Compton, San Francisco, Atlanta, Shreveport, Louisiana, Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh. So some big cities that have embraced this idea, and some have actually started to roll it out already. And you know, giving $500 or $1,000 to folks, and there's no work requirement associated with it. Mm. There's nothing. They just kind of get this check and get to, you know, live their life with it.
Yeah, so is that a good idea, or why is it a bad idea?
So it's bad for a number of reasons. I mean, one, it's incredibly expensive. I mean, that's not even the first reason, but it's just incredibly expensive. Mm. But I think the idea is, what's wrong with it is that they're trying to use this as a way to uplift people out of poverty and make things more affordable. But one, the reason things are unaffordable is because of government. So they should fix that first. But two, what you're doing is you're creating this disincentive to work for some. So right, so say you get this income, this $1,000 a month, because you make $24,999 a month. So instead of going to look for a job that pays you $35,000 a month, I mean, I'm sorry, a year, you're not going to do that because you're making $12,000 a year just sitting there.
Yeah.
So you're going to wait until you find something that's maybe $40,000 a year, $45,000 a year, $50,000 a year, which might not come immediately. And so you're just going to hold down that job, getting this guaranteed basic income, because there's no need to elevate to that next step. But I think the other issue is that they're saying that it helps alleviate costs of rent and food and all these other things. But, you know, you have like 5 or 6 cities in California that have done this. And when you look at California and look at the reason California is unaffordable, it's because of the government regulations that they've implemented. So I was actually doing some research on this, and in Los Angeles, it costs, and this is absolutely crazy, you can check this number, I guarantee you it's accurate, it costs $500,000 to build a one-bedroom affordable housing unit.
Cool.
In San Francisco, it costs $750,000 to build a one-bedroom affordable housing unit. And that's all because of the regulations and environmental fees and all these other things that California puts on. Now, in Texas, we know that's not the case. You can get a house, a very large house, for that amount of money. And so instead of giving someone $1,000 a month, why not look at the regulation that's driving up that cost for making it unaffordable to live? And so that's my issue, is that they're trying to just, you know, give you some money and say don't spend it all in one place, while they continue to levy these regulations that make it unaffordable to live and force people out. And that's why some people were coming from California to Texas.
Oh yeah. Well, and like you said, elections have consequences. Well, you can already look at the Democrat controlled cities across the country, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, and see what they are doing there, what they're doing to citizens.
Right. And you want to hear something even crazier though? I didn't include this in the piece because I didn't find out until after, but, and I think I wrote the piece and it came out Friday, and like Monday, San Francisco City Council passed this. And what they're doing is, theirs isn't just a guaranteed basic income for poor folks. It's a guaranteed basic income for the art community, because they said the art community is suffering because of the pandemic. So you have to be an artist and a poor artist to get $1,000 a month. So if you're just poor, I'm sorry, you're out of luck. You can't get the money. You have to be an artist first. So it's ridiculous.
It's ludicrous, and it doesn't work, and it harms citizens.
Right. And I think, you know, to your point, it doesn't work. I mean, you know, we talked about the costs driving everything up, but we also know, like data has shown for decades and decades and decades, that the way that you get out of poverty and you find upward mobility is through education, it's through gainful employment, it's through entrepreneurship, it's through home ownership, and being able to kind of, you know, create generational wealth and equity for your family. Those are the ways you do it, not by getting $1,000 a month and not by paying $750,000 for an apartment union in California. And so they're really addressing it the wrong way. I hate to, you know, assign intent to them, because but they're definitely doing the wrong thing, and there are so many ways to actually address the issue, and I wish they would do that rather than just throw out cash to people.
Right, and the consequences are very clear. It's not hard to see that.
Right.
Well, another big issue has been the police, right? So you look at Democrats gaining power in cities and what they're enacting, basic income, suffocating regulations, right? Another hot topic. Yeah. Police, you see Austin just down the street defunding the police, taking $150 million, cutting a third of the police's budget. You have had some interesting commentaries about that. Tell us where you stand on that, if that's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a ridiculous idea. And I think it's a ridiculous idea for a very specific reason. So the argument, if you listen, and I know you listen to city council all the time too, and so when you listen to them, you hear these people calling in and saying they want police reform, they want change, they want this, they want that. And then you also hear people calling and talking about crime. And a lot of times the crime is in low income or heavily minority communities, which often overlap each other, or a lot of the worst crime is in many instances. And so it doesn't make any sense for me that you're going to defund the police, which are the ones that are responding to crime in these areas, and which are, they already have delayed response times because they don't have the resources they need. And they need to actually be empowered to respond to crimes in those, in every area, but particularly in these areas that are higher crime. So the people who are advocating for defunding the police, I don't know if they, maybe they just haven't realized yet, but they're advocating to bring more harm to the communities that they claim that they are advocating for. Mm-hmm. And so you can't claim that you want to help, you know, poor people and minorities and this and that and the other, but want to take the police away from them. And there's even polls that show that overwhelmingly, you know, Black and Hispanic folks want more police in their area, or at least the same amount, but they don't want less. Like, they have been very clear that they don't want fewer police. They want more because they need the protection of them. And it's kind of similar to this issue where you see across the country where it's releasing a lot of folks out on personal bonds and not forcing them to pay. And so you're seeing them go back into these same communities that they came from and doing this crime again. And so it's hurting those communities. And so a lot of times these policies that they claim are meant to help these communities just do the complete opposite and just bring more harm and wreak more havoc on them.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your thoughts, Charles.
Thanks,
thank you so much for being here. Just want to give a quick shout out to our viewers. Please like and comment and share. Join the conversation and we'll get to your comments after the show. Want to give a few shout outs. Steph and Tiffany from Deer Park, welcome, glad to have you on. Ellen from North Shore Canyon Lake. Carol from Crowley. So thank you all for watching. Thank you all for joining us today. Make sure to get out to the polls. You've heard all of the issues that are going on, some of the big storylines, and plenty of reasons to show up and vote. Have a wonderful weekend. Thanks again for joining us, and get out there to the ballot box.
Thank you for listening to this week's Friday Roundup from Texas Scorecard. If you like this show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to get your podcasts. Don't forget to leave us a 5-star review while you're there. Texas Scorecard offers a growing number of podcasts, so give those a listen and subscribe to them as well. And remember, you can catch the show live and join the conversation every Friday at 11 a.m. on the Texas Scorecard Facebook page.